It's not a niche anymore. You know, we'll do over $1.7 billion in revenue this year. We're in over 13 million homes. And, you know, we took on those traditional audio manufacturers in the early days from the software side, and they've all tried to respond, whether it be Bose or Sony or LG or Samsung or any of those players. And none of them have been able to respond with a product and experience that is as good as Sonos because they don't have that expertise in software. For the tech companies, they've come in for reasons other than creating great speakers that and great audio products that really customers are going to love and they're going to use for a decade.
Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu einer neuen Ausgabe von Handelsblatt Disrupt, dem Podcast über neue Ideen, Disruption und die Zukunft der digitalen Welt. Mein Name ist Sebastian Mattes und ich begrüße Sie wie immer ganz herzlich aus unserem Podcast-Studio hier in Düsseldorf. Sie haben einst die Hörgewohnheiten in den Wohnzimmern der Welt verändert. Die Firma Sonos aus Santa Barbara in Kalifornien. Seit Anfang der Nullerjahre arbeitet die Firma an vernetzten Hören über alle Audiogeräte im Haus hinweg, drahtlos und einfach und mit oft ziemlich guter Lautsprecherqualität. So gut hat der Audio- und Software-Spezialist das gemacht, dass andere sich gleich daran setzten, genau das zu kopieren. Zum Beispiel der größte Suchmaschinenanbieter der Welt. Google ist vor 5 Jahren ebenfalls in das Geschäft mit kabellos vernetzten Lautsprechern vorgestoßen. Das wollte Sonos sich dann nicht gefallen lassen und hat Google verklagt. Bis dato erfolgreich. Das Gericht hat nämlich festgestellt, dass Google gegen 5 Patente von Sonos verstoßen hat. Google hat erstmal Berufung eingelegt, aber warum es trotzdem Sinn macht, einen Tech-Giganten zu verklagen und mit welchen Ideen es eigentlich losging bei Sonos, die ganze Geschichte, das bespricht mein Kollege Stefan Scheuer, der für das Handelsblatt aus dem Silicon Valley berichtet, heute mit Patrick Spence, der seit 5 Jahren CEO bei Sonos ist.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Generative KI hilft Unternehmen dabei, schneller, innovativer und effizienter zu werden. Doch wie können alle Mitarbeitenden diese revolutionäre Technologie im gesamten Unternehmen nutzen? Bertelsmann setzt dafür auf eine gemeinsam mit Deloitte entwickelte Plattform auf Basis von Campfire. Diese dient nicht nur als konzernweiter Software-as-a-Service-Marketplace, sondern auch als Distributionsplattform für eine Vielzahl von generativen AI-Anwendungen. Jetzt mehr erfahren auf deloitte.com/bertelsmann.
Und damit kommen wir jetzt zu dem Gespräch von Stefan Scheuer mit Patrick Spence, dem CEO von Sonos. Viel Spaß.
Hallo Patrick.
Hallo.
Patrick, maybe you could take us a little bit through how you got interested in pursuing this path in the first place. You finished your degree with a business focus, and then your first job, if I got it correctly, was already basically joining a company before they launched BlackBerry. So how did this came about?
When I was in university, I did an internship at IBM on the ThinkPad brand team. And what that really did was rekindle my love for technology. So when I was in third grade, we were one of the lucky elementary schools in the small town in Canada that I lived that was given a Commodore PET computer. And because my math grades were good, I got to use that Commodore PET computer quite a bit. And I got into programming. My parents ended up getting us a Commodore 64 at home, which I did programming on, and got into the early bulletin boards and modems, and I kind of got into technology. I lost it a little bit, you know, in high school and then into early university, but I really rekindled that when I was in university and did this internship with IBM. And that made me really focused on how I could marry technology and building a business really together. And so there was this, I thought I would go back to IBM when I graduated and work there a couple of years and then probably start my own company. But there was this opportunity to join this little tech company in Canada called Research in Motion, RIM. And I got to see an early version of something that would ultimately become the BlackBerry. And I saw it, and I really believed in the vision of computing coming together with wireless and connecting to the internet. And that really was the story. And that was kind of the bet that I made. And I met the two co-CEOs, founders, and it was an incredible group of people. And so I really believed in the mission of the company. The people were amazing. And I saw an opportunity to kind of leap ahead in my career and, you know, skip working at the big company and jump right into the fray of a startup at that particular point in time. And so that got me started in this journey. And 24 years later, here I am.
So looking at this decision at the time, I mean, Research in Motion only had 150 employees. You could have just followed the path towards IBM. I mean, with a degree in business administration from, the University of Western Ontario, that would have been easy. So why go for a 150 employee startup?
It was definitely the unconventional path. All of my classmates had never heard of the company, and most of them were going to companies you'd heard of, whether it was IBM or Procter & Gamble or Goldman Sachs or McKinsey. And I really felt like my passion was around technology and building products. And that really got me excited. And I thought there was something special in this area of melding internet, computing, and wireless. And I thought there would be a big opportunity there. And I really felt like that was being true to who I was and what I kind of wanted to do and what I wanted to work on. There's not a lot of companies that actually build physical products. And I felt that was a really important thing. And they offered me a great opportunity, you know, in a company like that to really get involved early, help shape what BlackBerry would become. And, you know, in a startup, you get involved in 100 different things instead of like one particular area that you might at a big company. And so this allowed me to really be able to learn a lot across the business and have kind of like a front row seat at building what turned out to be a global brand.
The global brand that reached one of its height, I looked it up in 2007 when the iPhone was launched. BlackBerry was actually the most sold mobile phone worldwide, which is absolutely incredible.
Yes.
You were part of selling the devices ultimately all over the world. So how did you came about that?
So I started actually in the product marketing team and actually telling the story and helping define the early days of the product and the offering. And then there were some opportunities to start working with companies and work with BlackBerry and show them how BlackBerry could help save time. And so I started to get into that entire area. I took a departure. So I worked and really helped create our first big successful vertical, which was with banks and brokerages that were using BlackBerry because they could save time. And that was absolutely critical to their business. But then I took a bit of a departure and went and worked for our chief information officer to put an ERP system in place because I wanted to understand more of the company. But then I had the opportunity to go start our business in Asia Pacific as well and really bring BlackBerry to, at that point, 6 or 7 different countries over there that didn't have BlackBerry. And what we did was really work with the local telecom companies. So a great example is Telstra in Australia and help use their sales force to introduce BlackBerry to companies because it was very company oriented at that point. So we partnered with Vodafone in Europe, for instance, to bring BlackBerry to businesses. And we were able to move quickly and grow and scale into a large organization. You know, when I left, there were 17,000 people. We'd done $20 billion in revenue. There were 80 million daily active users at that point of BlackBerry Messenger. And we did that with the help of all those telecom companies because they could really reach customers in a much faster way than we would have if we were building it all ourselves. So we really leveraged that infrastructure, those companies, to quickly, rapidly, you know, roll out around the world.
Right. You were part of this roller coaster of the company going up, but then also the company going down. I mean, when you left, BlackBerry was already in decline. Why did BlackBerry suffer so much?
I'm a big believer in a quote from Jim Collins, which is, whether you prevail or fail is really more about what you do than what somebody does to you. So a lot of people point at iPhone coming in as a disruptive force, and certainly it was disruptive in the space. But, you know, by that point, we had not moved our software to the point where we needed to in terms of apps. Like, yeah, everybody could see apps was coming and that was going to be the future. But we also made some, you know, missteps. One of the things that we did was respond to the iPhone by building, you know, a really competitive product. Verizon in the United States wrote us a big check and said, build a response to the iPhone, a touchscreen product. And we rushed that product out. And we really overnight, you know, gave up a lot of the goodwill that we generated over the last decade because we didn't develop a product that really lived up to the promise of BlackBerry. We also really had lost sight of who our customer was and who we were trying to serve. So instead of introducing the next best BlackBerry, we introduced, you know, a response to a competitive product. And that's never what you want to do. And then finally, we had a real opportunity with BlackBerry Messenger at 80 million daily active users to go cross-platform. We had it working on iPhone, Android, on PCs. But it was a classic innovator's dilemma situation where half of the organization didn't want to risk the hardware sales that happened to go and explore, you know, that business and build, you know, really what would have been a much bigger business than WhatsApp at that time. And so we got stuck in a situation where, you know, we just didn't make the right strategic call, I would say. And so those are all the different factors that I look at. And I really think, you know, these things are, they were within our control, you know, to navigate and have made better decisions. But unfortunately, we didn't.
Right. I mean, with Sonas, you basically chose to leave Research in Motion. You joined Sonas as a chief operating officer in, let me have a look, it was 2012?
That's right. Yep. 10 years ago.
Sorry?
10 years ago.
10 years ago, right. And during this time with Sonas, you've also managed to basically go into rather niche market that then has been growing quite massively. So take us a little bit through the approach of maybe also some of the lessons that you took from BlackBerry and learning and also maybe not repeating the mistakes.
Absolutely. Yeah. So 10 years ago, I met John, the founder of Sonos, and very much we hit it off because we really gelled over wanting to build you know, a company the right way and build it for the long term. And John had founded and built another company into a big business called software.com. And this was his second time through. And this was also my second time through. And so I joined when there were, you know, 200 people, $200 million in revenue. And I saw very much that I was already a customer. And so I believed in the mission of the company and trying to bring, you know, this music to every home around the world and do it in a different way. And I also met the people, and the people were phenomenal. And it reminded me, you know, a lot of the inventors and builders at RIM. And then there was just a great opportunity, I thought, for the company to actually change the audio industry. And so those things were the factors that I looked at. And certainly, like, I felt like this is a place that I could apply everything I'd learned at BlackBerry and do a little differently. And so a great example of that would be the IKEA partnership, for instance. So that was something that we were trying because I always want to make sure that we are looking at, you know, what the future might hold for Sonos, right? And Sonos is really the story of software eating audio. If you think about the Marc Andreessen quote of software eating the world, Sonos is absolutely the story of software eating audio.
Maybe let's take the audience a little bit, one step back, because there was an audio industry where you already yes. had established players that had great audio quality.
Yep.
But the niche market that you guys went into is connecting different devices without being necessarily having to plug in different cables. So having the same audio in one room, in several rooms, and then being able to ultimately control this from mobile devices, right?
So it really was the melding of so you're absolutely right. There was an audio industry already established and we were taking on giants like Sony, Bose, you know, Panasonic, massive companies. And what we did, you know, similar to how at BlackBerry, we brought the worlds of computing, internet, and wireless together. At Sonos, we brought computing. So really our speakers are computers. We brought as well wireless, you know, into the mix. So we were the first with Wi-Fi and connecting it together in that way. And then as well, cloud connection. So we connect you directly to the cloud, directly to, you know, at the original time, iTunes, but now to Spotify or any of music services that are out there. And so we really actually invented the whole category and disrupted the traditional audio space by melding those technologies together to create something which was super simple for customers. You could play a song in any room of your house or all the rooms in your house easily, like you said, from your originally a dedicated controller and then eventually a mobile phone. And so we brought all of those things together to make music really easy for people and be connected to the cloud. And so there were a whole bunch of tailwinds that were happening that we've ridden to the growth that we have today and have invented this category, which we knew would become much, much bigger. So everybody in audio tries to copy it. The internet tech giants have jumped in. But really, you know, we invented this category and we could see that it was going to be as big as it is today.
And then you actually became CEO in 2017. And now we're at the point that you already pointed to is the partnership with IKEA. That was, I think, about just a couple of months after you basically took over the realm of the company. Why IKEA, given that Sonos was before very much focused on a very also high-priced
yes.
Customership? Whereas IKEA had a different audience.
We're very focused on, you know, the premium, you know, building a premium brand, building premium products. But people will pay for that, you know, and people make choices every day in terms of the, you know, the sneakers that they're buying or the products that they want in their life, the phone, right, that they're purchasing, and they'll spend, you know, they're willing to invest in products of quality. And that's what we saw. And we sat down with IKEA because at first it wasn't obvious to us either, and looked at the people that are shopping at IKEA and how they compared to the audience that we're trying to reach. And there were a lot of people there, music lovers and people in a younger demographic that we thought, okay, this is interesting. And this would be an interesting way to bring people into the Sonos ecosystem in a different way. So it wasn't just, you know, a lower price, although that's one thing. IKEA actually created new form factors like a lamp, right, that we put music into, and as well into new countries. So we've been very much focused on Europe and North America. This allowed us to go global with them as well and really try that and see how that all would come together. And so it meant us really contributing the compute, you know, the computer inside, and then as well the software to run it, because it runs like every other Sonos product. But really, we melded those things together to create something special that helped us reach a whole new audience.
Right. You mentioned in the beginning that you were not the only company interested in merging software with audio. There had been other players entering the market, but namely Google was the one to really push in this market in 2020, while you also pursued a legal case against them. So why did you take on Google? I mean,
so we, yeah, so let's go back in time. So when we invented this category back in 2005, right, nobody else had taken software, computing, and wireless and melded it all together to develop, to basically deliver the amazing experience you have today with Sonos. Every player in traditional audio has tried to copy what we did, but they weren't born of software. You know, that 2/3 of our engineering team is software. It's the magic of Sonos. You know, along came Google, Amazon, Apple in 2015, 2016 in terms of those times. And so it validated the fact that we had chosen a market that is very big, because now all the tech giants are jumping in. But they were jumping in not to create amazing products that give customers the kind of music experience that we have today. They were, you know, they're jumping in because they had strategic reasons, you know, Google, for instance, to try and make sure that if voice was going to be the next big dimension of search, they were there and didn't lose their monopoly in desktop and mobile search, right? Amazon, so that they could make sure that they're being able to serve, you know, customers that are shopping, right? And with voice and some of those things. And so, they obviously, as these companies have come in, have, some of them have copied what we did. And, you know, that is, not right. And so we actually engaged in a conversation with Google and said, we're open to licensing you know, the technology. You can pay us because we invented this and you're copying what we do. And, they didn't take that seriously. So we had to, take them to court. And so we've done that. We've been successful in pretty much every action that we've had around the world. We had a 5-for-5 win at the International Trade Commission, which is pretty unprecedented. And you know, we continue to pursue that. We have two trials underway that'll happen next year, and continue to work our way through the courts to make sure that we protect everything that we've invented.
In the US, you even got a decision by the FTC to block imports of products that were using, I think it was 5 Sonos patents.
Correct.
So that Google wasn't actually able to sell those speakers here in the US market. This, from an outside perspective, also deteriorated your relationship with Google, right? They recently said they would be launching a whole range of countersuits on other topics. How is this going to play out? I mean, are you going to spend your time in courts now?
No, we have a great team, a small team that's very focused and has already shown to be very successful, you know, against one of the biggest companies in the world. So they have tried to, you know, retaliate in terms of trying to find patents that we violate, and we don't believe that we violate any of those, but certainly they're trying to, you know, take some attention and some focus away. But we, from the beginning, we have kept a very small team that's focused on this, and the vast, vast majority of the company and the vast, vast majority of my time is spent trying to innovate and build new products and attract new homes. And so the other thing that you will notice, even though all these tech giants have jumped into our space, is we continue to grow. And over that period, we've grown our revenue, we've become profitable. So we've built a strong, sustainable business over that period of time, and are well positioned to both stand up for what we've invented and as well continue to innovate, introduce new products like we did last week with the Submini, and continue to add more new homes, because we think we're still early days in terms of the number of homes that we can bring Sonos to.
So there are already a couple of routes that you have been taken to enlarge the product portfolio that you have, launching different speakers, as you just mentioned. But you've also gone into the market of having more software come in, for example, with voice. How would you say?
Sonos voice control. Voice control. Yeah. So we've, you know, it's been a long journey. We've been at this for a while. So we started in a category called components, which powers other people's speakers. And, you know, so in-ceiling speakers or, you know, Bang & Olufsen or other speakers that you connect to. That's where we started. Then we moved into speakers ourselves, right? And so we took the brains and the component and all that computing and put it inside, you know, the best speakers in the world for their price point, right? Then we expanded into home theater, so soundbars and subwoofers and some of those products. And then recently we've also expanded into portables. So with the Move and Roam, we're in another new category now. And so we're methodically, you know, going through and expanding the range of products. And as we do that, we're attracting more customers, and we're also increasing the number of products per home, which is very important. So we're creating homes that have a lot of Sonos products. We have an experience in our app. And then as well, we've augmented that with Sonos Voice Control, a new innovation through an acquisition we made a few years ago, where we have a very, very focused voice assistant. It's focused on music, and it is the fastest voice assistant out there, and it's also the most private. So we do not take your data into the cloud. We decided to approach this very differently than those companies that are playing in voice to collect data and try to monetize that data. And we think customers will appreciate that.
But help me better understand of where this niche then stays for you. You said you were the ones combining software with traditional audio devices.
Yeah.
But now you have the audio manufacturers, the traditional ones, catching up. We have the ones like the big names that we already talked about, Bose, Sony. We also have quite a few names in Germany and in Europe, Sennheiser, Teufel, and others. So they are expanding in this field. And on the other hand, you have traditional software companies that are also going in that direction. We have Apple with AirPlay. Google also has not been silent in this industry. They're also pushing. So from two sides, your competitors are trying to squeeze into your market. So where is your position in the long run?
So it's not a niche anymore. You know, we'll do over $1.7 billion in revenue this year. We're in over 13 million homes. And, you know, we took on those traditional audio manufacturers in the early days from the software side, and they've all tried to respond, whether it be Bose or Sony or LG or Samsung or any of those players. And none of them have been able to respond with a product and experience that is as good as Sonos, because they don't have that expertise in software. For the tech companies, the big tech companies that have come in from the other side, you know, they have very different strategic intent. And so they've come in for reasons other than creating great speakers that and great audio products that really customers are going to love and they're going to use for a decade, right? Our products last forever relative, whereas these products that some of the tech companies are making are ones that are pretty disposable, quite frankly, and pretty basic, because they want to capture your data and approach these other areas. And so we've grown every year that we've shipped products, and we've been shipping products for 17 years. We've been around for 20 years. And we do that because we stay focused on the customer. You'll recall that I said for my BlackBerry experience, we got too focused on the competition. We've stayed focused on the customer. When Google and Amazon jumped in with their cheap devices, we didn't go build a cheap device. There were some people that said you should go build a cheap device. We did not. Instead, we innovated on the voice assistant, and we're the only company that supports multiple voice assistants, right? And so we quickly got Amazon's Alexa and Google Assistant on the platform. And we let customers choose. And we let customers choose the music service they're going to use. They don't have to use the one that the hardware they bought comes from, right? And that's the push from some of the big tech companies, is to use the service that also comes from them. And so we provide customers the most choice out there and the best products. And that's continued to be a winning strategy. And what's really important is we continue to innovate and introduce at least two new products every year. And I'm confident that as long as we do that, we will continue to take more and more of the $96 billion audio market.
So you have been one of the CEOs of a smaller company, smaller comparing to the big tech giants, that has been very vocal also on criticizing the legal framework in which those companies are operating and the way that they're also using their market force. So what do you think has to change to, in order, enable or even make competition easier?
There, you know, I really think that any time that you have, you know, too much power in too few hands, it creates a situation that is dangerous for society, quite frankly. There's not a lot necessarily that has to change in the laws, but regulators need to enforce the laws. So, you know, companies shouldn't be able to go sell their products at a loss so that they can drive competitors out of the market. This is exactly what Google did in photos. There were 20 or 30 different photo companies in the early days. Google made theirs free, drove everybody else out of the market, and then magically, when they drove everyone else out of the market, they actually started charging for their product. And that's exactly the kind of consumer harm that we as a society don't want, because they become monopolies and they can go do those kind of things. And so the laws exist for this to get enforced. We've seen Europe take a more aggressive approach on this with some areas and trying to create laws that help competition. But fundamentally, some of it is the regulators taking action in certain situations and enforcing laws like predatory pricing or self-preferencing of their own services. And then there's some unique things. You know, we wanted to be able to run Google Voice Assistant simultaneously with Alexa. Amazon was okay with it, but Google blocked us from being able to do that. And so, you know, that's not in the best interest of the customers. And we want to act in the best interest of the customers at the end of the day. So there's some legislation in front of, you know, US lawmakers right now around antitrust that would be helpful to push across the line. And then, you know, regulators like the FTC and DOJ, you know, need to enforce the laws that are on the books and make sure that we don't end up all, you know, working from and buying from one big company.
Right. Especially mentioning Europe, the pieces of legislation that are now being pushed through are massive. Especially the Digital Markets Act is probably going to label companies such as Google or Apple as gatekeepers, which comes with a whole variety of other requirements that those companies will be facing. So looking at the audio world in specific, do you think there will be new opportunities? How are you looking at how the European market is going to change? Do you see specific chances that would emerge from those new legal frameworks?
Absolutely. The opportunity to be able to offer all of these services, make sure they're accessible to all the players, that is a necessary condition for, you know, continued innovation and disruption and all the things that we need. And so that should create the conditions where we can offer, you know, multiple voice assistants simultaneously and not be blocked, you know, because somebody chooses to block it. So that's an important one for us. Or self-preferencing, where, you know, if somebody is searching for Sonos on a website and a company decides to pitch them on their own product instead of the Sonos product, like those behaviors are not ones that help us create competition and do the best thing for the customer at the end of the day. And so I am hopeful that the legislation moving through now in the EU will help foster that.
A lot of the things that you mentioned are rather looking at Google, but the Apple ecosystem is much more sealed off than the Google one is. So how do you perceive the the Apple ecosystem and how this might potentially change with the Digital Markets Act?
Well, I think, you know, this gets a little bit outside of where I play, but from my perspective, I think from what I've seen, a lot of the Apple questions relate to the App Store, right, and things there. And so we don't sell an app. We have an app, obviously, that we offer for free. But certainly, I think the ramifications of the Digital Markets Act in Europe or some of the legislation in the US will be aimed at Apple's, you know, monopoly on the App Store, for sure.
What I was rather thinking of is if you want to control several Audi devices with your Apple device, the easiest way to do it is through Apple AirPlay. Mm-hmm. And you guys are offering alternatives. So yep. Do other competitors. Is that something that you are concretely looking into, that you could use the legal frameworks created by the DMA to force Apple to open it, at least?
Well, good news. Good news. So given the customers that we have, right, both Apple Music is available on Sonos, and we're the only ones. So they opened that to us because of customer demand and the artists that said, hey, if you want me to use Apple Music, it needs to be on Sonos. And then as well with AirPlay, Apple has opened that up to Sonos. So you can use your iPhone to connect to Sonos via AirPlay as well.
But if I get it correctly, you have to pay royalties to Apple to be allowed to use it, correct?
There's some technology and things that happen, you know, behind the scenes. I don't think that royalties necessarily are a bad thing for people that invent certain technologies. And, you know, there's also relationships between companies. You know, if there's certain things that one company offers another, you know, and opens these things up, those are kind of natural relationships where, you know, the partnership becomes stronger.
Right. So looking at the future of the business for you guys, there has been a lot of talk of new device categories. You filed a patent that looks very much like a headphone, but you haven't launched a headphone yet. So is there a Sonos headphone coming? And if yes, when?
We kind of have a two-pronged approach. One is to continue to raise the bar in the categories that we're in today. So, you know, whether it's components or speakers or home theater or portables, like we did last week with the Sub Mini. Then there's new categories out there that, you know, are huge opportunities for us. But we need to be careful. We don't reveal our future roadmap because obviously competitors are paying attention to those kind of things. But, you know, I've often shared that we are working on more things now than we ever have. And we see a lot of opportunity to really use our software first approach to go and take more of that $96 billion audio market. So stay tuned for more.
And looking at your current business, for quite a while, you as well as analysts had been quite confident that you would not be hit as hard by the recession as other companies have, as you're targeting a very well-off customership.
Yep.
Your products are damn expensive, so not everybody's going to buy them. But what we've also seen, especially during the last quarter, is that also you are feeling the recession and customers making different choices. So how hard is it going to be for you guys?
So you can get started with Sonos for $169. So it's well within the range for most people. But what we saw in June was kind of like a two-pronged issue. One is consumer demand started to slow down. So we actually, in April and May, were right on exactly where we'd expected to be. And we see registrations every single day. So the minute somebody turns on their Sonos, we actually see that they've done that. April and May, right on plan. And then in June, we saw a drop off. We launched a new product. We didn't see the demand materialize in the way you would have expected. And then the second thing that happened was a lot of retailers got cold feet on orders because they started to see customers pulling back as well. And so there was a marked change in June. We also said when we came out and gave our earnings that we had assumed in this quarter that we're in right now that it would stabilize to slightly soften. And 2 weeks ago, we came out and affirmed that. So we said we are on track for what we had said at that point. So we have seen it stabilize to some degree in terms of where it is right now. Now, given that we saw a change in that behavior in June, I want to be careful about how we think about the future. So I think the name of the game right now is adaptability and just paying attention to what's happening out there and then adapting as necessary. We have a strong balance sheet. We're profitable. We've got an exciting roadmap. So we feel pretty good about where we are for the long term. And I'm confident that we can navigate the ups and downs of the short term and whatever happens in the economy. So it appears that it'll be, you know, a little bumpy for a while in the economy, and we just have to be adaptable and be able to, you know, make sure that we're making the right investments, staying on track for our long-term roadmap, and remaining profitable.
Could you specify that a little bit further? How bumpy is it going to be? Like, what is your assessment on what you guys?
If I knew that, I'd be an economist. So,
Okay, but you give a forecast on how your stockholders as well as analysts are looking at the company. You lowered this forecast. Now you said your lower forecast is probably going to hold. So it's not getting worse, but it's also not getting better. So we are in a pretty difficult situation, are we?
We definitely see macroeconomic headwinds right now. But I think we also have to be mindful that that people have been calling, you know, for recession. Some people are seeing challenges, some are not. We've seen some green shoots this week with more affluent consumers, to your point, and they're buying. So Ralph Lauren came out and said they're seeing strength. Cody came out and said the same thing. And so it's complicated right now in terms of the situation. I think we are, for the first time in 3 years, in a decent inventory position heading into the holiday period. We've been, you know, trying to catch up on demand for the last couple of years. And so we will actually be there for the consumer. And what we just need to see is, does the consumer come out in the holiday period and actually buy products? And that's not within our control. I think in these situations, it's really our job to make sure that we're focused on what we can control. And what we can control is making sure we have great products out there. They're ranged well. We're telling our story through advertising and brand activities. And so that's where we're focused right now.
This is then the second level, right? You're talking about the inventory. During the COVID times, there had been a lot of hiccups, not only for you, but almost for every company that is not producing right next to their headquarter.
Yeah.
So how have you adjusted your supply chains during the COVID situation, and how are you looking at the years to come?
So we started just a little bit before, the pandemic. We had started to diversify our supply chain into more countries. So we had originally just been in China. Now we're in China, Malaysia, Vietnam as well. So that helps us in terms of some resilience. The other thing that we did through the pandemic that we hadn't done before to this level is we had a team that actually would work on changing the computer board inside each speaker to be able to get the components that are out there and create the product and make sure that it was still going to live up to the experience. And so, you know, we ended up in a situation where usually we would have two boards for each speaker. And in some cases we had seven different boards just because we had to pull different components together and try to put them together a bit like a puzzle. And so the team did an incredible job adapting on that front, but we also had to pay for things like air freight. We had to pay and buy certain components that were short in the what's called the spot market. And so you end up paying a lot more than you would in your typical course of business. And so we felt the effects of that into our business as well. It was a really, a really intense period. I think our team did an incredible job. Now we're seeing all those things, you know, kind of come the other way, right? And start to come off. And so I do think, you know, it was a very rapid and expensive, tight, you know, kind of supply shock. And now I see it coming off the other way. And so what we'll be watching is, does it come back down to kind of the prices and the availability and all those things that were there, you know, pre-pandemic? What does that swing really look like? But I am optimistic that we're seeing like a lot more components become available. And then we're also seeing prices.
Nach einer kurzen Unterbrechung geht es gleich weiter. Bleiben Sie dran.
Wie wird unsere Wirtschaft eigentlich klimaneutral? Das ist eine der wichtigsten Fragen unserer Zeit. Und das Erste, was wir dafür loswerden müssen, sind auf jeden Fall fossile Denkweisen. In der Handelsblatt Green Innovation Week dreht sich deshalb vom 6. bis zum 10. Mai alles darum, wie die Klimawende gelingen kann. Und welche nachhaltigen Entscheidungen Sie jetzt für sich und Ihr Unternehmen treffen können. Seien Sie dabei. Digital, im Blatt, als Podcast und live. Mehr unter handelsblatt.com/greeninnovationweek.
So that's a good thing as we think about the longer term.
So you said that you changed your supply chain. You're now not solely relying on China, but
correct.
Could you refer us to a couple of numbers, like how many of the components or of the products is still being manufactured in China, or where parts of it are still manufactured in China, and how much is coming from other markets.
So, you know, for the last 40 years, right, there's been a general migration of the supply chain into China. We have hundreds of components that we purchase and put into our products. And many of those are only available in China. So our manufacturing, we have diversified from China, and we have multiple manufacturing locations in China. We now have multiple in Malaysia and multiple in Vietnam as well. And so we're always adjusting which ones go there, but we still continue to build products in China. So, and then we continue to source components that are available in China. And those are in Malaysia, helping us there do manufacturing, those kind of things. And same with Vietnam. There are, for anybody in the supply chain right now, you know, most, I should say, there are some components that you could probably only get, you know, in China, for instance. And so it'll take years for the component suppliers to also move to where some of the manufacturing has migrated to. And so we've seen that with some of the key suppliers starting to have locations in Malaysia or Vietnam as well, so they can source right next door to the manufacturing plant and that kind of thing. But given this has been a 30, 40 year migration of all those things to China, I expect it'll take years before there's full diversification of the entire supply chain. So right now it's mostly manufacturing, but you'll see more of those components over time.
Could you give us a number? How reliant are you still on China?
It just varies depending on the product that we have. So we still manufacture, all of our products, we'll do some manufacturing them in China. I'm not going to give you a number, but, ultimately, we will build in all three of those countries and maybe more into the future as well.
We see Apple now shifting some of the production out of China with the new iPhone. We see other electronic companies doing the same. Do you have a long-term goal to be more resilient when it comes to, just coming back to the China example, we have Shenzhen now on lockdown. We have Chengdu now on lockdown, which is, again, creating ripples to the supply chain, especially with Shenzhen, where so many also of your component makers are located. So what's the long-term goal? How reliant on China is still okay in the long run to be more resilient?
I think the ideal situation is, so the perfect situation would be, in every country we do business, we have a fully, full supply chain and manufacturing and all of those things. I'm not sure we'll get there from a cost perspective. That requires the entire industry to operate a little differently. But I do think, given what we've learned in the pandemic, we'll see more opportunity to have closer manufacturing and supply chain to the customer than we have in the past. So, 50, 60 years ago, right? Most of the things that you bought would have been built nearby, say in the same country that you're in. I could see us over the next decade getting to a point where, a lot of the things we buy in North America may be largely manufactured in North America. Those things bought in Asia, largely manufactured in Asia. And some of these things, just to set ourselves up for a situation where, should we have another pandemic or geopolitical issues, right? That countries are more and regions are more resilient. And so I can see that being a potential based on what I'm seeing in the supply chain and the way that people are trying to build something that's more resilient.
Just to be clear, so you plan to build a factory in the US or in Europe?
No, and we work with manufacturing partners. So we work with companies that specialize in actually doing manufacturing, and then we have our people, work with them and support them. But I'm seeing some of those companies, those contract manufacturers, actually start to open locations in the United States, Mexico, Canada, in Europe as well. And so over time, if they do that, and all of those component manufacturers start to make components in all the other countries around the world, companies like ours could actually leverage that and be able to use those. And so, and not just us, everybody, right? And that might actually spur more manufacturing innovation and more hardware made all throughout the world, which would be pretty exciting.
Right. But then let me just specify that one of the manufacturers working for you would open a plant in the US if you probably would signal that you would also be willing to pay a markup because you can say it's made in the US. The same thing with Apple. They don't produce themselves, but they gave a hint to Foxconn to relocate to India, as they said that they would allocate, for example, the production of iPhones there.
Yep.
So you are the one basically directing the companies.
Well, we're not as big as Apple yet. So we don't direct them as much as partner with them on where they're going to go. And when they're putting a manufacturing facility in place, certainly they're asking us, Is this an area that you would want to use, right? So because we're not in every manufacturing facility with all of our partners, we're in select ones. And so so they will ask us and say, hey, you know, if we open a plant here, is that something that you'd be interested in? And we kind of work with them through that. So
right. The question with China is also interesting from this geopolitical mm-hmm. point of view, as there are, we've seen it with Russia, but now China is also one of the countries that is facing increasing scrutiny from the United States, but also in Europe. So how do you see that play out in the long run, also for you as a US-based company?
Yeah, I think I certainly hope that. So I've had a chance to work, you know, across dozens of companies at this point. You know, we took BlackBerry from the small town in Canada and into 162 countries. I've traveled to a lot. I've been in China. We have people in China. We have people all over the world. We did a BlackBerry too. We're much more similar than we are different. Everybody's, you know, just trying to build a good life, have a family, all of these things. I'm an optimist, so I believe that over time there'll be more recognition of that, and countries will, you know, probably look more for how they work together and the common good. So I expect that, yes, there will always be like geopolitical issues between countries and challenges like that. That's why, you know, supply chain resilience, I think, helps us just for health epidemics as well, geopolitical issues. But fundamentally, like the world is getting smaller and will continue to, and it should, because we're all, you know, just trying to, you know, build businesses and lives and families and all the things that we do. And so, you know, there'll be the ups and downs geopolitically, but in the end, I think, we'll continue to work together, and the world will get smaller.
Okay. Just before we end the interview, there is one topic that I'd be pretty interested in. You are, to some extent, also a scout for new technology all over the world. So what is the most interesting piece of technology that you have looked at recently and you said, oh, wow, this is actually pretty cool?
You know, I've been doing a lot of wearable tech lately. So an Oura Ring. I've used the Whoop band as well. One of our board members, Tom Conrad, is CEO of a company called Zero that does like health tracking and intermittent fasting tracking. And so I think that's an interesting area in terms of wearables and health, is a pretty interesting space. I've invested in a drone company, as well. And so that's kind of interesting. A robotic food company. So robots are a big area.
And robot food,
yeah,
meaning so like I have a robot preparing food for me.
Yeah. And so it, you know, you start with like certain, easier foods like, smoothies, or ice cream and some of these things. But in over the long term, you could see that the robots could actually, and we've seen this, there was a startup that did pizza, and there's a variety of different ones like that. So robots will play, and look, like the biggest robot that we all have in our house is a dishwasher. Like it is a robot in a way, right? So I think those are kind of vectors that I'm looking at, and I'm always trying to support any founders in the hardware space, because there are fewer and fewer of us, quite frankly, now working on hardware and actually building physical items. So I like to support as many as possible.
Yeah, let's see what is going to hit the market in the years to come.
Yeah.
Patrick, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks, Stefan.
Und damit sind wir auch schon wieder am Ende von Handelsblatt Disrupt. Wie immer freue ich mich über Kommentare in der Handelsblatt Disrupt LinkedIn-Gruppe oder senden Sie mir gerne eine Mail. Die Details finden Sie in den Shownotes. Danke an dieser Stelle auch für die Unterstützung von Max Flohr und Regina Körner und Migo Fecke von professionalpodcast.com, dem Dienstleister für Strategieberatung und Podcastproduktion. Wenn Sie grundsätzlich immer auf dem Laufenden sein wollen, dann testen Sie doch gern unser exklusives Abo-Angebot für Sie als Handelsblatt Disrupt-Hörerin oder Hörer. Damit lesen Sie nicht nur alle aktuellen Artikel und haben Zugang zu unserem Archiv, Sie können natürlich auch alle Podcasts hören. Schauen Sie doch einfach mal nach unter www.handelsblatt.com/Mehrwirtschaft. Die Details auch dazu finden Sie natürlich in den Shownotes. Wir hören uns dann nächste Woche Freitag wieder. Bis dahin wünsche ich Ihnen interessante digitale, aber natürlich auch analoge Zeiten. Ihr Sebastian Mattes.
C3. Zinsen, Immobilien, Geopolitik, das Jahr der Entscheidungen. Das ist das Motto des diesjährigen Bankengipfels. Banken sehen sich gerade mit einer Vielzahl von Krisen konfrontiert. In dieser Situation sind unabhängige Information und Orientierung wichtiger denn je. Beim Bankengipfel erwarten Sie daher News und Networking sowie wertvolle Impulse von Vordenkern aus Banken und Tech. Wir freuen uns auf Sie am 4. und 5. September in Frankfurt. Mit dem Vorteilscode Bankengipfel24 erhalten Sie 15% auf den Teilnehmerpreis unter handelsblatt-bankengipfel.de.